It's great to be with you this morning, Southlands. We're continuing in our Exodus series that we've been going through for the last couple months. And if you were here last week, Joel preached out of a kind of climactic moment in the text, in the story of the Exodus. It was the Red Sea moment, this kind of great moment where God demonstrates his power in parting the sea, making a way for the Israelites to be delivered from the Egyptians, from Pharaoh. But the text we're going to look at today in chapter 15 through 17 is kind of like this letdown moment. You go from this kind of like God demonstrates his power to then the Israelites are very quickly kind of disgruntled. They're complaining. They're not happy. They've forgotten what God has done for them. And they're just not trusting in God. And there's this word that comes up again and again in this passage. Leaking water. We're going to be talking about thirst in this sermon, so that's appropriate to have some water dripping. Illustration, indeed. So the word that comes up again and again in these chapters that we're going to look at today is grumbling. So I want to talk for a few minutes about grumbling. What does that word mean? And kind of the points I want to make today in my sermon are, why do we grumble even after God delivers us, even after we're saved? Because I think we experience this as well. Why do we continue to have things we're disgruntled about? Why do we grumble at God? So this word grumble, before we get into the text, I just want to kind of talk about this word because I think it's just kind of a funny, interesting word. The definition in the Oxford English Dictionary is to complain about something in a bad-tempered way. And the Hebrew word that is translated grumble in the passage is loon, and it's defined as referring to semi-articulated mutterings of disaffected persons. So the gist of it is grumbling is like a really annoying sin, right? It's sort of like this toxic mix of gossip and like kind of discontentment. It's this semi-articulated, under your breath muttering, complaining with a bad attitude behind someone's back. Now, for leaders, for anyone in authority, parents, bosses, like this is like a really annoying thing. Like, people grumbling, muttering under their breath, disaffected people. It's almost like you wish they would just speak their disgruntledness to your face, right? So to be grumbled against is not a pleasant experience. So imagine how Moses and Aaron feel. Imagine how God feels when his people are grumbling against him. But grumbling is also really toxic for the grumbler. When we grumble, this is a very dangerous thing. Because I think grumbling is like a gateway sin of sorts. It leads to other sin. To grumble is like to till the soil so that other seeds of sin can take root. So we have to be very careful with grumbling. Like if you're a teenager grumbling against your parents a lot, just kind of like everything they do annoys you, you grumble, I think that probably makes you more likely to disobey, to rebel. If you're a spouse and you grumble against your spouse, everything they do annoys you, you grumble. Like, I think that probably makes you more likely to have wandering eyes, to look elsewhere. So we have to be really careful about this gateway sin of grumbling. Because what happens with grumbling is it creates bitterness in our hearts. It creates hard-heartedness that can lead to all sorts of negative places. So one of the interesting things about grumbling that I saw in these passages is that sometimes it says they grumbled against Moses, their human leader, and sometimes they grumbled against God. And ultimately, I think all of the grumbling that we do is a grumbling against God because it reveals like things about God that we're not believing, things we don't trust God for. So what are those things? What leads us to grumbling? What are the roots of grumbling? That's what I want to look at today, and I think there's three episodes in these chapters that each are related to physical thirst, physical hunger, and in each of these three episodes, I think there's something we can glean in terms of a root cause of what leads us to grumble. Okay, so why don't we turn first to chapter 15, and we'll look at the first of these episodes and kind of look at the dynamics at play that leads the Israelites grumbling. Okay, and keep in mind as we read this, like this is just like a month after the Israelites have been delivered. So it's very fresh. Like they've seen the plagues, they've seen the parting of the Red Sea, God has demonstrated his power, his love, his provision, and yet they grumble so soon. So let's start reading in chapter 15, verse 22. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled in the desert without finding water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink its water because it was bitter. That is why the place is called Marah. So the people grumbled. There it is. They grumbled against Moses, saying, "What are we to drink?" Then Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became fit to drink. There the Lord issued a ruling and instruction for them and put them to the test. He said, "If you listen carefully to the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all his decrees, I will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you." Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs and 70 palm trees, and they camped there near the water. So God has given them water. He's kind of brought them to this oasis-type place. He's delivered them from that situation. But then look what happens next, so soon after this. Chapter 16, verse 1. The whole Israelite community set out from Elim and came to the desert of Sin, interestingly named, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had come out of Egypt. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted, but you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." So there you have kind of the beginnings of their grumblings, right? The people of Israel saying, like, "We wish we were back in Egypt. God, why did you bring us out here only to be hungry? I want to be back in slavery. I want to be back under the thumb of Pharaoh, because at least I had food." Like, imagine that. Like, you've just been delivered from slavery, and you want to go back because your tummy isn't full. So I think the first lesson we can see about what leads us to grumble, what is our root cause of grumbling, is just that we aren't grateful for God's gracious gifts. You know, what's interesting about the kind of tone of this passage is just how childlike the Israelites seem. Like, they're just like, we're thirsty, we're hungry, our bellies aren't full. Like, they sound like little babies. And I was probably thinking this because I'm about to have a baby of my own. I'm about to become a dad for the first time. Kira is due with our son in just about a month. And I've been thinking, you know, yes, so we're excited about that. I've been thinking about how I think parenting will show me new aspects about how God views us. And one of those is, like, when our baby is delivered, after, like, Kira goes through this crazy labor process, it's painful, like, she, like, does miracles almost to get our baby out of her womb into the world. But is that baby going to respond immediately with, like, "Thank you, Kira, thank you, Mom, thank you for everything you did"? No. He's going to respond by crying. He's going to respond, like, for the first couple of years, only by crying because he's hungry, because his belly is empty, or because he needs to be held. And so for the first couple years of our parenting this child, like, it's gonna be a very one-sided, lopsided relationship. It's gonna be us pouring into him, caring for him, sustaining him, and us getting nothing back. He's not gonna acknowledge what we've given him. He's not gonna be grateful for it. It's gonna be a one-sided relationship. But what I know is gonna be true is, even in that, we are gonna have such joy. There's going to be such joy in just looking at this child's face, you know, nursing from Kira, and seeing that beautiful, intimate dependency that he has on us. And I think that's something of how God views us. Even when we're disobedient, even when we're ungrateful, when we show our dependency on God and it's this very one-sided thing, God experiences great joy, like a parent experiences, because his people are dependent on him. Now, that's not to say that eventually we will want our son to mature in the direction of gratitude. Like, eventually, at a certain age, we'll be like, "You have to say thank you when you get something. You need to be grateful for the food you're given." And we will expect him to articulate that. And I think God is the same way with his people. He wants them to mature in the direction of gratitude, because he knows that ingratitude will easily lead to rebellion and disobedience. When we don't take time for gratitude, I think we set ourselves up for sin. We become entitled. We think that what we get is somehow deserved, that what God is giving us. It's the beginning of a lot of our sin, ingratitude. Think back to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Like, I think this is a classic example of ingratitude. Like, God had given them this entire garden of delights, these amazing trees, all this fruit. they had all this stuff, and instead of being grateful for it, what did they do? They went for the one thing that they couldn't have, the one forbidden fruit. And so from that, we have the original sin. It comes from this place of ingratitude. You know, ingratitude, I think, is a sin that we struggle with, especially in consumeristic cultures. So Orange County is a pretty, like, consumeristic culture, right? Like, we are in this affluence. We look around. We see all these things that, man, I wish I had that car. I wish I had that house. We look around on Instagram. We see people doing things, buying things, going on trips that we wish we had. And so it's easy to be ungrateful because we can spend more time looking at what we don't have than reflecting on what we do have. My temptation in this area is travel. So I'm like, we love traveling. We've been able to do a lot of amazing travel in our marriage. But I often find myself, instead of like thinking about, reflecting on the amazing trips we've gone on, I often think about what my next place is I want to go to. Like, over the summer, I've been looking at Instagram and seeing, like, friends going on epic hikes in the Swiss Alps and going on the Inca Trail in Peru or whatever. Like, and I'm just like, man, I wish I could do that. Like, when can we go there? Like, I want to go to there. Like, I want to do that. And in that moment, I'm not being grateful for what I have done, because I could just reflect on literally 3 months ago. I was in South Africa for 2 weeks seeing amazing things. You know, in previous years, I've gone to Europe. I've done amazing things. So that's just one example of how we can so easily be ungrateful when we spend more time looking at what we don't have than what we do have. So if ingratitude is the beginning of sin, if that can be a root cause of sin, then the flip side, I think, is also true, that gratitude, having a life of deep gratitude, can be a gateway to obedience. It can help us be more obedient and virtuous. So I think we need to think about, how do we kind of cultivate habits of gratitude in our life so that we can more easily obey God? Some things that I would suggest in terms of habits of gratitude is simple things like prayer before meals, like just acknowledging the food that we have to eat right now came from God. Like, that's a small thing we can do. Even when you're out at a restaurant, I know it's awkward to pray in public at restaurants, be sure to tip well, but like, I think that's a good thing to do, right? Pray before meals. Pray at the start of every day. Like, acknowledge, God, you have given me breath. You have given me another day that I don't deserve. And start your prayers every morning with thanks. Don't just rush into things you want God to do for you. Start with thanksgiving. That can help inculcate gratitude as an ethos. And then a third tip I would say is just create space. Like, create space to enjoy what you have. We move so quickly from one consumer experience to the next in our culture. But if we create space to, like, enjoy the gifts that we have, like, enjoy a walk in your neighborhood. Look around you and see the beauty of Southern California. I mean, come on, we live in Southern California. People come from all over the world every summer to visit here. Like, we went to the beach on Friday night just to walk along the bluffs, and it was beautiful. And we were just remarking, like, man, people from all over the world come here and see this, and we get to live like 15 minutes away. So take time to reflect on that. Take time to be grateful. And I think that will kind of keep you from that temptation of ingratitude, which can easily be a gateway to sin and grumbling. Okay, so lack of gratitude, I think, is a root cause of grumbling. Another, I would say, is impatience. We sin because we aren't patient with God's ways. We aren't satisfied with kind of the timeline, the instructions God gives us. We're not satisfied with the cost of obedience. We want to do it our way. It may be a good thing that we're getting, like manna and quail, and we're about to read that passage, but we just don't want to do it on God's terms. So let's read this passage in Exodus 16 where God provides manna. He provides this sustenance. The Israelites are hungry. They need food. God provides manna and quail, but he gives them specific instructions, right? It comes with specific ways that he wants them to receive this gift. So let's read chapter 16, beginning in verse 13 and going to 28. In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp. And in the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, finest frost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each of you, as much as he can eat. You shall take an omer according to the number of the persons that each of you has in his tent." And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. And Moses said to them, "Let no one leave any of it over till the morning." But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat, but when the sun grew hot, it melted. On the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay aside to be kept till the morning." So they laid it aside till the morning as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, "Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none." On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws?" So in this passage, God gives like two specific instructions that come along with the gifts of the manna, right? Like, only gather as much as you need for that day. Don't hoard it and carry it over to the next day. And then there's not going to be any to gather on the Sabbath. So gather twice as much on the sixth day. But sure enough, like, the Israelites, at least some of them, don't follow those instructions. They're impatient with God's ways, with his process. They want to do it their own way. You know, I had a theology professor once define sin in this way. He said, sin is wanting the right thing in the wrong way. And I think this is what's happening here. Like, the manna is a good thing and it's good to desire it, but if you don't go about getting it in the way God has laid out, like, that's sin, that's disobedience. And again, we can go back to Adam and Eve and look at that original sin in these terms. So Adam and Eve, like, God created them to grow, to be mature, to become more like him. But the process through which they were to mature was intimacy with him, like walking with him, learning from him, growing from him. But Adam and Eve are impatient. They want to be like God. They want God-like wisdom and knowledge, but without that long, patient process of having to do it with God on his timeline. So what do? They go and pick fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil because they want to be like God immediately. They don't have the patience for it. And sure enough, that's the beginning of sin. It's impatience. It's taking a shortcut. The thing that they wanted, wisdom, to be like God, is a good thing. That's what God created them to grow and develop. But they couldn't do it on God's timeline. They couldn't do it through fellowship with him. And that's a key here. God wants us to be doing things through him in that intimacy way. But Adam and Eve didn't have that patience, so they bypassed God. So much of sin, I think, is like this. It's us wanting something that might not be a bad thing, but if we do it in the wrong way, it's sin. So think about like theft. You know, you see something you want, but instead of going through the virtuous process of earning enough money of your own to purchase it legally, you say, "No, I want that right now. I don't have the patience to go through that whole process, so I steal it. I want it for myself now." So theft is an example of that. Think about like sexual sin. Couples who are engaged, who are dating, like having sex together is a good thing that eventually one day through the path God has set out for them, marriage, it'll be a great thing. But instead of waiting for that, instead of going through that process, a lot of times we're impatient. We just have sex before the covenant of marriage, and that is sin. So those are like big, heavy examples, but a smaller one is also true. Think about like deceit, lies. Oftentimes when we're talking with someone and like the truth would be like so complex, it would take so much time to, you know, go through the truth of it and the nuances and the complexity of it. Like, it's just easier to just kind of twist it a bit and then like tell a lie. Like, oftentimes that's where deceit comes from, impatience with the process of telling the truth. So sin is shortcuts. Sin is taking shortcuts. And you see that with Israel in this example of the manna and quail. They can't go, they don't want to wait for God's process. They're hungry, they want the food now. They want to hoard it. They don't believe that God's instructions are good. You know, when we try to go too fast, when we're impatient with process, bad things happen. An example of this that I'm sure most of you have experienced is like following instructions in building something. Like, you know, IKEA and their like crazy complex like building instructions that you get. Like, I've been doing a lot of that in preparation for our baby's like furniture recently. And usually I'm a pretty process-oriented, patient guy, and I actually do follow the instructions like perfectly. But in one case recently, I was like, I had it in my mind that I wanted to put this piece of furniture together like in the next 2 hours. I had to get it done. So I went a little too fast. And sure enough, I somehow misread a step, didn't read it carefully, and I got to that annoying point where it's asking you for a certain screw, and you're like, wait, I don't count enough screws. I used it, oh man, I shouldn't have done that. And you have to like undo everything and go back, and it takes twice as long to get the thing built. So impatience leads to bad places. It's better to be patient, to be disciplined, to kind of follow what God has laid out in terms of obedience steps. So lack of gratitude is a root cause of our grumbling of our sin. Impatience with God's process, I think, is a root cause of our sin. But another big one, and I think maybe the one that the other two actually stem from, is this. We don't remember. We don't remember God's goodness. We're forgetful. And we see this in chapter 17, in kind of the third episode of the Israelites being hungry and thirsty in the desert. So this is like a deja vu scene. It's interesting because literally like a few paragraphs earlier in chapter 15, they had the same exact thing happen. They were thirsty, but God provided. He showed up, he provided. And yet it seems like here they've already forgotten that. They're facing the same situation, needing water, and they're saying like, God, like, why are you not giving us water? Take us back to Egypt. So let's read a bit of this passage in chapter 17, verses 1-7. All the congregation of the Lord, of the people of Israel, moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages according to the commandment of the Lord, and they camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore, the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and the people, of course, grumbled against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried to the Lord, "What shall I do with these people? They are almost ready to stone me." And the Lord said to Moses, "Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come of it, and the people will drink." And Moses said, in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the name of the place Massah in Meribah, because of the quarreling of the people of Israel and because they tested the Lord by saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" So again, the Israelites are having like this same experience, having just been thirsty in the desert once and God providing, and here they are in the same instance, and yet they're still doubting. They're still not trusting God, and it comes from their forgetfulness. They've forgotten that God provides. And I think that we often in our lives can be the same way. Our grumbling comes from a place of forgetfulness. We just don't remember. We don't rehearse God's faithfulness to us enough. And so we're prone to not trust God. Like, I don't think God is going to like care for me because, I don't know. And it's usually because we've forgotten. Forgetfulness, short-term memory, makes us vulnerable to sin. When we're so preoccupied with the now, like, what are my physical needs? What do I need from you now, God? That we don't remember the big picture, that we don't see God's faithfulness throughout time to his people, like, we are vulnerable to grumbling and to sin. And there's different attributes about God that if we forget them, it leads us to different sorts of sin. For example, like, if we forget that God is holy, then we won't fear his wrath and we can minimize and justify our sin. When we forget that God is sovereign, that he's in control of all things, we can live with an unhealthy anxiety that everything depends on me, and it can be a paralyzing anxiety. when we forget that God is a God of transformation, that the Holy Spirit is a spirit of resurrection and has the power to change people, when we forget that, we can start to see our brokenness and kind of our sin as this unchangeable part of who we are. We can start to define ourselves by that. And all of those are bad things. When we forget God's attributes, who he is, bad things happen. So we need to remember. The antidote to this is being people of remembrance. Southlands, we need to be a community of remembering who God is, what his attributes are. You know, as someone who has grown up in the church, I was in church like my second week of life, and I haven't missed a lot of Sundays since. Like, I can become complacent in terms of thinking, like, I've got this, like, I've read the Bible front and back so many times. I know God's attributes. Like, I know who he is. I can become complacent. But I often forget God's attributes. Because I'm a sinner, because I'm human, like, I will often be like the Israelites and be more concerned with the challenges right in front of me, and I can forget the big picture of God's faithfulness. So I need to remind myself of who God is. I need to surround myself with reminders of God's faithfulness. We need reminders because we are sinners. We're prone to forget. We're prone to wander, as the song goes. So how do we do this? How do we remember? What are some kind of memory tools that we can use in our community? The first is just what we do on Sundays. On Sunday mornings, we rehearse God's attributes through songs, through worship songs that declare these attributes of God. We do it through Bible reading, through preaching, through prayer. But it's important that we don't just do these things on Sunday. This is why, like, the disciplines, the devotional habits of the Christian life are so important. Like, whether it's CBR or some other Bible devotional you do throughout the week, it's important for a lot of reasons, but one of the biggest is that it constantly reminds you who God is, who he has been, who he is, who he will always be. That's what the Bible is. The Bible is God's self-revelation to us, telling us about who he is. So we need to be reading the Bible. We need to be praying. We need to be doing these weekly, daily habits in order to remind ourselves. Another thing that I think is important is the Christian calendar. So these moments on a yearly basis, like Advent and Christmas, which helps us remember when God came to earth, when he became human for us, and then Lent and Easter, another period of the Christian calendar every year where we remind ourselves, we tell the story every year of God's amazing rescue project of the gospel, of Jesus going to the cross, dying on our behalf, and raising again. Like, I think it can become easy year after year to be bored with, like, Christmas and Easter and just be, like, to minimize it. Even, like, in churches, sometimes we can be like, oh, what are we going to do this year for, like, Christmas Sunday? Or, like, what are we going to do this year for Easter? But it is a profound gift that God gives us these yearly rituals of remembrance. Because we're so forgetful, it's an important thing to embrace the church calendar and to sync our lives to the rhythm of it. One of the Jewish kind of holidays that even to this day is celebrated is Passover. And of course, what does Passover remember? It remembers the very story that we've been going through, the Exodus story, God's deliverance of his people from Egypt in that Passover moment. And, you know, it's interesting that it was on Passover, the Jewish holiday of remembrance of God's deliverance, that Jesus had his kind of upper room moment on the night before he died, where he gathered his disciples to celebrate the Passover, and he kind of reframed this ritual of remembrance by instituting a new meal, a new kind of Lord's Supper. And I just want to read a little bit of that moment in Luke 22. It says, "And he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, 'This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' And likewise, the cup after they had eaten, saying, 'This cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood.' Do this in remembrance of me." I remember growing up in this Baptist church in Oklahoma, and the altar had that across the front. Do this in remembrance of me. I remember that visual so clearly. That is why the Lord's Supper exists. Jesus knew that even his disciples, even the ones who were closest to him, who walked with him in life, even they, like the Israelites, would be forgetful. They would be prone to forget what the sacrifice was. They would be prone, even after God has done these dramatic things, parting the Red Sea, dying on the cross, rising again as Jesus did, we are prone to forget. So we need tools of reminder. And that's what the Lord's Supper is. And it's interesting that Jesus uses food. Like, food is the chosen medium of remembrance. And isn't that interesting? Like, I think it's because food is so tied with memory. It's so tangible. But also because it gets at sustenance, right? It gets at this base, like, elemental human need for bread, for, you know, water, for sustenance. And, you know, Jesus, in this moment, he's wanting to say, not that you need bread, not that you need wine, but you need me, right? He's making the connection that he is the bread. This is my body. This is my blood. And elsewhere in the New Testament, he calls himself the living water, right? He calls himself the bread of life. He's trying to communicate to his people that I know you have physical needs and I will provide for that, but ultimately what you need is me. I am the final and ultimate sustenance that you need. So both in these kind of hunger and thirst episodes that we looked at today in Exodus and in kind of the New Testament, the message is still the same. God wants his people to trust him and to come to him for the living water, the bread that is always going to be there. He's the ultimate sustenance. And ultimately, I think salvation boils down to this. Like, salvation is really just us receiving this sustenance. It's us acknowledging, Jesus is all I need, and I'm going to accept that and recognize that you are the only thing I need. I think we can overcomplicate the gospel. We can overcomplicate the Christian life. But really, it's simple. It's about trusting God, trusting that he is enough, and truly believing that, that he is enough, that there's nothing else that will satisfy. There's no other thing I need to do except receive. Take, eat. This is my body. This is my blood broken for you. We just need to accept that. It's really simple. It's easy. You know, and yet we have such a hard time letting that sink in. And God has to hammer this home to the Israelites in the desert, right? It takes 40 years for them to truly get to this point of trusting that God is enough. They were stubborn. They struggled to trust him. Time and time again, they had these moments where they forget, where they're impatient, where they're not grateful. They don't trust God. They look to other idols. They look to themselves for strength. But what God is doing is refining them. He's refining them. He's teaching them to trust him. So ultimately, it's not about giving or withholding provision to his people. For God, it's not a game of like, I'm going to give you some food here, but I'm not going to give you some there. For him, it's all about intimacy. It's all about, I want you to come to me for your sustenance. I want you to trust me. It's this beautiful kind of this dance of intimacy. I remember P.J. Smythe once used this illustration about like the way when we seems like we're wrestling with God, like it feels like, God, why aren't you giving me this? We're in these wrestle moments with him, like. And it's like this image of a little kid wrestling with his dad. Like, the kid might be punching and, like, really angry and wanting to wrestle. And from the dad's point of view, he's just loving it, right? It's just like, this is great bonding time. I love just hugging my son, my daughter. And that's what God is that's how he approaches these, what looks like a wrestle to Israel, what looks like a wrestle to us, is to him intimacy. It's this cosmic cuddle, is what PJ said. And I love that image. Like, it seems like a wrestle, a battle from our point of view, but from God's point of view, it's creating intimacy with him, and that's the point. That's the point of it. When we do get to that point of trust that he is enough, when we do value intimacy with him above all things, even above our physical hunger and thirst, then we won't grumble as much. Then it'll be easier to kind of obey him and to follow the steps he's put out for us to live an obedient life. This week, Kira and I were in a baby care basics class. We're learning the basics. This is our first baby. So we went to this class. It was one night. It was like changing diapers, washing your baby, all the things you need to know to not kill your baby in the first few months of life. But one of the questions the nurse who was leading the class asked at one point, and she threw it out to the class, she said, what do you guys think is the most important lesson that your baby needs to learn in his or her first year of life? What's the one thing that they need to learn? And someone threw it out, and it was the right answer, and that is trust. That's the only thing your baby needs to be taught in their first year of life, trust. That is the beginning of every healthy relationship, trust. If you don't have trust, you're not going to be able to mature. You're not going to be able to obey your parents. Trust is the foundational layer. And it takes time, you know, it's not an immediate thing. Like, our baby, when he's born, is not going to immediately trust Kira and I. It's going to take a period of time where we pick him up when he cries, we feed him when he's hungry. It's not going to be this immediate thing. It's trust is built over time, and that's why it took 40 years for the Israelites to be refined to this point of truly trusting their God. And so we need to be patient in our lives. Sanctification can be a frustrating process because it can take time, but ultimately it's all about learning to trust God in a deeper, more profound way, because otherwise growth and obedience is really hard if you don't have that trust. So trust is cultivated over time. You know, just as lack of trust leads us to grumble and can lead us to sin, it's trust that allows us to obey. So I don't know if you guys have heard the song Trust and Obey. It's like an old hymn. We used to sing it a lot in church growing up. But I'm just going to like sing the chorus really quickly and see if it jars anyone's memories. It goes like this. Trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. Some of you remember that song. Like, I love that song because those two words, like, really capture the entirety of the Christian life. It's about trust and obey. And the order is important. It's not obey and trust. The order is important because trust, as I said, is the foundation that allows us to grow. It allows us to obey. We need to trust God in order to be able to obey him. So we need to trust and obey. And that's the journey. That is what the Christian life, sanctification, is all about, and yet it is a struggle. And so I just want to land, you know, and the band can come on up. I'm sure there's people in various places in your Christian walk today, and all of us, I think, have moments where our trust level of God is higher or lower, and we kind of doubt God in certain respects. But I just want to have us, as we go to take communion, this meal of remembrance where we remember what God has done and remind ourselves of the gospel. As we take communion, I want us to take a step back. Like, if there are areas of your life where you're struggling to obey God, if there's areas of righteousness that you struggle with, chances are that comes from a place of not trusting God. So I want us to take a step back in our minds, search our hearts. If we're struggling with obedience, what are the areas of trust that we're struggling with? What are we not believing? What are we not remembering about God? What gifts of his are we not grateful for? All these things I've talked about today. You know, we are often disobedient because of our forgetfulness, because of our lacking of trust in God. So as we go through this ritual of remembrance of communion, let's pray through areas of our lives where we haven't trusted God, and let's embrace the intimacy with God that is sanctification. It can feel like a wrestle, but it's God embracing us and saying, I will sustain you, but I am all that you need. And as soon as you trust that, it'll become a lot easier to obey.